1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio. For three decades now, the first-person stories of and by the greatest rock musicians in history. I'm Redbeard, your conductor on this rock and roll train. And today in the studio, the members of U2 join us. Their concert film and number one selling soundtrack album, Rattle and Hum.
We've had to do the stadiums, which, quite frankly, really take it out of you. And we don't want to be touring for the next 2 years, you know. We want to be finished by Christmas and start work on our movie, which is a concert movie, which is our only real cure to this problem, which is to do a movie of the show and everyone can get the best seat in the house when it's released.
Well, there's a history of people from rock and roll going to Hollywood and never coming back, you know. And Elvis, I suppose, is the best example. So long,
Angel of Harlem. If there's one thing I'd regret of the 80s, it was just an uptightness. And it was an uptightness that sharpened our music on a lot of levels, but it spoiled our own enjoyment of it.
Bono, The Edge, Adam Clayton, and Larry Mullen Jr. return with me in the studio for the 10th anniversary of the movie and soundtrack, Rattlin' Hum. As we packed up the recorder and microphones following one of my interviews with U2 in Dublin, lead singer Bono reminded me that every Irishman in every pub has a certainty to their opinion on any subject, and they'll not hesitate to share it with you. So this might take a while, so you better just pull up a chair and draw a pint. Sifting through the copious reviews of both U2's rockumentary film and soundtrack album Rattle and Hum, released in fall 1988, leads me to conclude that Rattle and Hum's net effect was to make every music and film critic Irish. But leave it to Bono, The Edge, Adam Clayton, and Larry Mullen Jr. to start a fight. For instance, on AllMusic.com, Heather Ferris calls the Rattlin' Hum movie, and I quote, one of the most distinctive rockumentaries. While on the very same site, Stephen Thomas Erlewine called the film, quote, disastrous. And while Ms. Ferris characterizes U2's musical performances as mostly gripping, Erlewine vehemently disagrees, describing the music variously as embarrassing, awkward, and in at least one case, shameful. Even the dearly departed popular movie reviewers Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, they couldn't even come close to agreeing about U2's Rattle and Hum. Even when they had the number one album in the world, The Joshua Tree, Bono claimed that U2 were no strangers to controversy.
The U.S. is a different place for Irish people than, say, English people. English people are just jealous that they're no longer an empire. And they're so pissed off with the U.S. So that's their problem. We go there, we just had the best time of our life. I couldn't believe to be in these cities, like to be in Chicago, to be walking around Chicago where this music had come from, to be in Memphis, to be even Los Angeles, you know, just this whole, just, you know, an entire, you know, county of swimming pools.
It actually felt like home because the Irish had built it.
But it was just, we had this love affair with the country, but at the same time, we could see that this dream that we'd all bought into was really starting to fray at the edges. And we could see that the big ideas of America were being shrunk by the minute. And we could see after, you know, Watergate and Vietnam, and now that they're beating up Nicaragua and El Salvador, it was all getting a bit sour. And that's why for the Joshua Tree, we chose a desert as that image. Because this place that we loved, that's what it turned and had turned into in the 80s. Right in the middle of its most successful time on Wall Street, when people were, you know, shoveling countries up their nose, and there was just this vast material wealth. It seemed like a desert to us.
Alluding to legendary singer Billie Holiday, Angel of Harlem, but the actual recording session was done in another soul kitchen, the world-famous Sun Studio on Union Avenue in Memphis, Tennessee. Those are the Memphis horns of the late Andrew Love and Wayne Jackson on Angel of Harlem. Here's U2 bass player Adam Clayton.
The people of Memphis really went out of their way to make it work for us in the studio. They were very, you know, they were very pleased that we'd gone there and that we were prepared to make a go of whatever was there. And you know, we said, look, whatever local instruments there are, if any of your friends have got some instruments, we'll use those. And you know, if anyone wants to kind of sit in on the old Hammond and any singers around, girls singers. So we had a bit of a fun, we recorded a couple of new songs for ourselves. And
oh really?
We got a lot of work done that night. You know, the groove like was there, you know. You know, that's the heart of rock and roll, in a sense. That's where it was invented, and it kind of jumps off the walls at you.
U2 guitarist The Edge still marvels at recording at Memphis Sun Studio.
Great room. Amazing sounding room. The funny thing about Sun Studios is we got there with Cowboy Jack Clemons, walked into the room, which was at that point had just been taken over and made a studio again. It was a battery repair shop for like 15 years. And Bono said to Cowboy Jack, who'd actually been an engineer on some of the Elvis sessions, you know, hey, you know, how did you get that Elvis vocal sound? And Cowboy said, hey, well, we used this old mic, one like just like that one. And he pulled out this old mic that was in the corner. He says, well, and we just put it there and then set it up, bit of slapback tape echo. And next thing, Bono's like singing through this microphone. And it was unbelievable. It was eerie. The sound that came out was like the sound that we all know from those records. And it's in the bricks and mortar. It's in that room. And so you can hear a little bit of that in Angel of Harlem.
Bono of U2.
Bob Dylan said to me once, he says, wasn't it strange? He said, everyone's talking about Elvis in Memphis. Elvis ice cream, Elvis this, Elvis that, you know. He said, there was a king died in Memphis, you know, a real king, you know. That was his name, but that was his state of being. And he was talking about Elvis. I would say that both of them changed the temperature of the United States. It could be argued that music did more than Martin Luther King. But let's accept that they ran in tandem. And for Irish people, these ideas of, you know, passive resistance weren't just, you know, this isn't just idealism. This was in our country, which was being ripped into by sectarianism and, you know, the evil tide of territorial claims. This man's position was poetry for us. And you know, John Hume and David Trimble, two Irishmen, got the Nobel Peace Prize for trying to put stuff together in our country, in Ireland. And I know one of them, I know John Hume better than I know David Trimble, and his biggest inspiration was Martin Luther King. And on the last tour, when we played Belfast, we played Pride in the Name of Love for him, and it made same sense in Belfast as it did in Memphis.
When I talked to U2 backstage on that tour, bass player Adam Clayton, for the first time, hinted at the changes that superstardom had brought to U2 with the number one success of the album, The Joshua Tree.
We were talking, you know, about everything calming down. When we go back to Dublin, part of the process of that is to strip away the kind of layers of rock and roll. When you've been out on the road for a while, you kind of get obsessed with, you know, radio, traveling, meeting people, cars, girls, guitars, all this kind of imagery that really and truly you think is like so important to your creativity. But at the end of the day, what's important is getting back home and stripping that stuff away and realizing that, you know, if you're writing a song, you're writing it for people who have no experience of maybe all of that. You need to relate to people on a simple human level. And once you've got those kind of barriers of paranoia up that inevitably present themselves in the course of a long tour, you can kind of get to the roots of what's happening. So when we made The Joshua Tree, it was like, well, we knew we'd made a record that was honest and down to earth. And we were kind of, we thought, well, maybe it's too down to earth. Maybe we've actually made a folk album and people aren't going to be all that interested in it. So we were like in this total bubble, you know, yeah. I mean, people who were in America at the time were saying, you know, there's this buzz about your next album. And, you know, after the kind of Amnesty tour, you know, this record's going to be really big. And we were saying, yeah, we've heard all that before, but, you know, as far as we're concerned, we're just concentrating on getting the record finished.
At the time, it had been almost 10 years since festival seating was allowed in U.S. arenas because of the trampling deaths of 11 concertgoers at a Who show in Cincinnati in 1979. No band dared challenge it for fear of seeming insensitive at best, reckless at worst. Here's Bono, followed by Adam Clayton of U2.
Thing that actually about rock and roll in America is that up until grunge, it wasn't physical. Those venues, you know, they had seats in them. It was really difficult to get the groove. It was really difficult to have the rise and fall, you know, like the waves breaking that we were used to in the smaller venues. When we went to arenas, it got really tricky. And that's, I think that's why there had to be that's why Nirvana, that's why these bands had to come and find a way of making rock and roll physical. It's also, it's supposed to be a dance music as well. That's another thing. That's the next step. So when can you actually get the groove going through a venue? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's not supposed to be sitting there and indeed standing on the seats. It's supposed to be more physical.
Yeah, we didn't really know about kind of incitement to riot laws because that's what we thought a gig was. And, you know, in Europe, it was all GA and standing up and stuff. So that was difficult playing the arena and knowing you had to stay on the stage.
Yeah. dollars. She's my potential. Yeah, she's a promise. In the year of election.
Desire with that intoxicating Bo Diddley beat. When we come back, Bono and The Edge have some startling admissions about the preceding album, The Joshua Tree. Plus, Adam Clayton reveals how U2 hooked up with legendary blues man, the late B.B. King. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for U2's Rattle and Hum. We're back in the studio for U2's October 1988 Rattle and Hum soundtrack. I'm Redbeard. The year prior, U2 released The Joshua Tree, which would go on to become not only U2's first number one seller, but one of the greatest albums of the 80s decade. Yet, U2 lead singer and lyricist Bono admits now that they all felt frustrated at the conclusion of recording The Joshua Tree.
I just remember when we finished that album, myself and Larry went off together to the Caribbean. It was a big trip for us, and we went to Chris Blackwell, who owned Island Records and brought Bob Marley to the world, etc.
Bahamas.
There it was. Okay, the Bahamas. Yeah. And we went there. I remember thinking, this is like Butlins for Millionaires or something. We were like, phew, what's all this? But having a great time, couldn't believe it, being looked after, and so depressed about that record. And we wouldn't play it for about 5 days. Then we played it, and we just both looked at each other and was just like, man, we really, it's always the same, isn't it? And then I said, yeah, let's just not put it on. We're going to ruin this trip. So we just put it away, never listened to it again. We were that depressed about it.
In the shit house, a shotgun. Praying hands hold me down. Only the hunter is hunting in this tin can town, tin can town. No stars in the black night. Looks like the sky fell down. No sun in the daylight. Looks like it chained to the ground, chained to the ground.
The water said. Exit soul if you want a way out.
Gold.
the going. She them captains and kings. She them navy blue uniforms. Temperature is rising. The fever weight hot. Mister, I ain't got nothing. Oh yes, more than you got. She ain't no longer by me. Not the shackles in my feet. Outside of the prisoners, inside the free. Set them free. Spider in a corner is told, hit where it hurts, silver and gold, silver and gold. Yeah, silver and gold. The song was written in a hotel room in New York City. Around about the time a friend of ours, little Steven, was putting together a record of artists against apartheid. It's a song written about a man in a shanty town outside of Johannesburg. A man is sick of looking down the barrel of white South Africa. A man who is at the point where he is ready to take up arms against his oppressor. A man who has lost faith in the peacemakers of the West. While they argue, and while they fail to support a man like Bishop Tutu and his request for economic sanctions against South Africa. Am I bugging you? Mean to bug you. Okay, Edge, play the blues.
Guitarist The Edge agrees with Bono that for all of its acclaim, he felt that the band could have done even better on The Joshua Tree.
I remember feeling that we had a few really strong tunes on the album, all right. I think we all recognized that With or Without You and Still Loving Family or Looking For were great tunes. But I actually remember feeling a little disappointed that we hadn't managed to push up some of the other tunes, the ones kind of on side two, and that I left feeling that we could have made an even better record.
It was beaten up pretty badly in the UK, and we're living in Ireland, so it's next door, so it depends. I mean, it's funny, records, you know, albums are reviewed completely differently on different continents. Rattlin' Hum was reviewed really well in the UK and killed in the US. Joshua Tree was great in the US, really bad in the UK. So, you know, you had a few thumps, a few punches. But only recently now have I realised that it is a very special record. But at the time, we were always, every night when we played on the road, we were trying to remake it and get it right. That's the truth.
One aspect of Rattlin' Hum that was universally acclaimed was the surprising collaboration between the Irish modern rockers and American blues icon B.B. King. Adam Clayton told me the inside story backstage before a U2 concert on that 1987 tour.
B.B. was playing Dublin, but it was before we'd released The Joshua Tree. And we went along to see him on a night off, and Dublin's a small town, so we went backstage and met him. We kind of went backstage to say hi and how much we'd enjoyed it. And the outcome of it was about a month later, he got in touch and said, would Bono and Edge be interested in producing some tracks with him? And we kind of thought about it for a while and thought, how's our schedule, blah, blah, blah. And if we're going to do it, we're not going to be the guys who fucked up B.B. King. So in the end, it was decided that it really wasn't anything that we could do this year. And we had to clear the decks as much as possible. I mean, we've had to turn down an awful lot of offers of... Obviously, there's a lot of kind of charitable work coming in. But there are also opportunities to work with people, and there just isn't really time. Because it takes a commitment. You can't say, yeah, I'll do it, and hope that you turn up.
That's what I'm talking about. The late, great B.B. King testifying with U2 on 1988's Rattlin' Hum. But how did their 1987 Joshua Tree tour become a feature-length motion picture? Bono, The Edge, and Adam Clayton return in a moment for the answer. For this and your favorite interviews, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio of U2's number one album, Rattlin' Hum. Welcome back in the studio for U2's October 1988 film and soundtrack album, Rattlin' Hum. I'm Redbeard. Backstage on the 1987 U2 Joshua Tree tour, U2 bass player Adam Clayton first revealed to me that the band's popularity was actually creating challenges for them.
We've had to do the stadiums, which, quite frankly, really take it out of you. And we don't want to be touring for the next 2 years, you know. We want to be finished by Christmas and start work on our movie, which is a concert movie, which is our only real cure to this problem, which is to do a movie of the show, and everyone can get the best seat in the house when it's released. So I don't know what the solution is. I don't know where rock and roll goes when it gets this big. There are a lot of people trying different things. You know, nobody wants it to become stadium, because if it's stadium, it's not rock and roll. So you have to find different ways of getting to people. Don't want to raise the ticket price either, because that's elitism. You don't want to play 10 nights in the one city, because that would take you a month to do two towns, you know?
How do you solve these problems?
I don't know. I'm a musician. I'll leave it to the promoters.
U2 guitarist The Edge told me that, initially, the idea for a tour documentary filmed seemed simple enough.
The whole idea was that we were coming to the end of the Joshua Tree tour. We had this movie we were shooting, and it was really, at the end of all that 2 years of madness, we wanted just to put out a movie that would go into maybe half a dozen cinemas across America, really small, and maybe there'd be an album which would be a kind of scrapbook of, you know, moments from the tour. Boy, did we get that wrong. I can't remember when, but somehow that plan just ran away with itself.
It was our fault. We actually agreed to that. In the end, we signed up for the mega thing, and it did our heads in. But Edge is exactly right.
That wasn't the plan.
That wasn't the original plan.
What actually happened, we started funding the film ourselves. That's actually what happened. Suddenly we realized that from starting to make a small film, suddenly we'd actually spent a very large budget, and it was a case of one wouldn't go into the other, so we had to rethink the plan.
hands up to me. His face red like a rose on a thorn bush, like all the colors of a royal flush. And he's peeling off those dollar bills, slapping them down. 100, 200. And I can see those fighter planes. I can see those fighter planes. Across the mud huts where the children sleep, through the valleys and the quiet city streets. We take the staircase to the first floor. We turn the key and slowly unlock the door. A man breathes into a saxophone. Through the walls we hear the city groan. Outside it's America. Outside it's America. The difference between ABC News, Hill Street Blues, and a preacher in the old time gospel hour, stealing money from the sick and the old. Well, the God I believe in isn't short of cash, mister. I feel a long way from the hills of San Salvador, where the sky is ripped open and the rain pours through a gaping wound. Pelting the women and children, pelting the women and children. Run, run into the arms. Of America.
The Edge admits that when U2 allowed the original tour documentary concept to get hijacked by Hollywood, it was a vulnerable position for the band that could have actually hurt them in the long run. Edge goes first, followed by Bono.
I think we came close to getting it wrong in over the Rattle and Hum movie. Not the movie itself, but the way that the movie was marketed and the way that it came out. And that was, I suppose, maybe just naivety on our behalf. We got into the project at a stage where we were financing it ourselves. We knew it was what we wanted to do, to document that tour and that record. And before really working it out, we came to the conclusion that the only way we could actually finance the film to the standard that we wanted to was by involving a major studio. And that was really, we painted ourselves into that particular corner economically, financially. Our original intention was that it would be a much smaller affair in terms of its launch and its distribution. It would be more like a kind of a small thing when it would be on in one cinema in each city, not as it happened 300 across the whole of the United States. And I think that that was the moment where we realized that we were dealing with a situation that could go one way or the other, and that we really had to keep on our toes with that side of the business, that it had the potential to really scuttle the boat if we got it wrong. And I think it took a while for us to get over that. I don't mean personally as a band, but for our audience to kind of come to terms with what had happened during that period. And I think that we're certainly a little wiser now about how presenting what you do in a wrong way can really give people a kind of warped impression of what you're trying to do. Well, there's a history of people from rock and roll going to Hollywood and never coming back, you know, and Elvis, I suppose, is the best example. I suppose we just didn't appreciate what a big machine, you know, the film business is, and film marketing. And the penny dropped with me when I saw these 12-foot-high portraits of each band member in a cinema foyer, and I saw that they'd airbrushed out the stubble on my face, so I looked better, you know. And then I thought, you know. Then I realized what we were part of. And to be fair, the people in Paramount did what a very sympathetic job, in that they tried to fit into the culture that we were part of as best they could.
They did.
But it was just a question probably of scale, you know.
So how do you avoid? I mean, you got to a precarious edge, no pun intended, a precipice. How did you reel it in?
Well, I think one thing is not to be defensive, and we've been very defensive in the past. Again, I think that's an Irish thing. You know, if your back's up against the wall, you can get quite aggressive. And even musically speaking, this has been true. And that appears to some people as pompous, you know, like or not giving access or precious, you know, that kind of thing. I think we've learned recently to just, that we actually have in the end, that we've nothing to hide, you know, as a band. So why don't we just kind of, you know, maybe we should, you know, a bit of glasnost could go this way, and this particular gang of four has nothing to hide. So we just kind of we had to let go of something. I don't quite know what it was that we were letting go. We were holding on to the group too tightly. And I think it came across, it made the music a little too taut. It made squeeze my voice. And it was just coming out of Dublin, coming out of Ireland, not knowing how the hell to be in a rock and roll band, not knowing what you should do, not wanting to get ripped off, not wanting to get, you know, all not wanting to fall into those traps, and kind of not being very loose about it. And
it's understandable, though.
Yeah, but if there's one thing I'd regret of the 80s, it was just an uptightness. And it was an uptightness that sharpened our music on a lot of levels, but it spoiled our own enjoyment.
But U2's Bono remains passionate about rock's viability in the 21st century.
I think rock music is a bit boring at the moment. I think that the pop groups have the better melodies, and they're sexier, and they've the better arrangements. And I think, but I think that the hearts of people in rock and roll bands are always going to be harder and truer than those in pop groups, where people are just, in the end, they're just making a tune to catch you, you know, to catch you. It's a hook. And I still believe that there's people out there who want everything from their music, who are living in it, and it's all and everything for them. And it is for us right now. I think I speak for everybody here. We feel more determined than ever to follow that through, that thought, that, you know, that music can actually change, if not change the world, change the temperature of the world. And that means on every front, it means changing your world. It means changing everything for you, the way you see the world sexually, spiritually, politically. And we're just that, always going to be that band that overreaches and wants all of these things. And we'll take the hit for it, and doesn't matter. But That is the reason why we make music, is we want actually, we want it to count. We want it to make a difference. So, you know, we're not shying away from that. In the 90s, we got into an area where I think, you know, the music got a little bit more intimate, and the hypocrisy that we were having a go at was more our own hypocrisy, and the hypocrisy of just relationships and your own heart. In the 80s, there were easier, you know, more determinable bad guys, and we were having a go at them, but it's the same. I'd like to think it's the same righteous anger.
Don't believe in forces. I don't believe in rain. Every time she passes by, wild thoughts escape. I don't believe in death row, skid row, gangs. Don't believe in a Uzi, just went off the mind. Believe in love. Don't believe the devil. Don't believe his book. The truth is not the same without the lies made up. Don't believe in excess. Success is to give. Don't believe in riches, but you should see where I live. I believe in love. Don't believe in rain, but every time she passes by, wild thoughts escape. Don't believe in death row, skid row of gangs. Don't believe in the Uzi, just went off in my head.
Part 2, a nod to the late John Lennon from U2's Rattle and Hum. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Bono, The Edge, and Adam Clayton. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.